Okay, so, how did we do that? Having never done anything like this before, I'm not sure. Maybe I'll just begin, and it might be a little bit pedantic, but I'll just start from scratch, and, you know, I guess to the extent that it seems a little rote, maybe you'll forgive me. But anyway, let me just kind of give you what the sort of mission parameters were in a sequence like this. One was, it read as a completely seamless experience that, given the underlying theme of the movie, which is a picture that takes place 4 years from now, at the eve of the millennium, in the year 1999 to the year 2000, where a technology exists that enables you to record other people's experiences directly off the cerebral cortex, basically using the optical nerve as your vantage point. Okay, so this sequence read is a pure and seamless uncut experience. And I really mean pure and uncut. Okay, you read it as a filmmaker. I also developed the script. But when you're developing and you're writing and you're using, you know, the keyboard, anything is possible. Then you've got to switch hats. Now you've got to start thinking as a director, how are you going to accomplish this? And how are you going to accomplish this on film? 35 millimeter. In videotape, this was about... This is maybe a six-minute sequence. On videotape, you're not hampered by the, you know, by magazines and the fact that, you know, film will run out and the amount of light that you need, the light levels. You're shooting all at night. I'm seeing 360 degrees. So none of those kinds of concerns. Well, let's just say the concerns are exacerbated once you have to shoot this in 35 millimeter. All right. So now, how do you do it? No existing camera was going to give me, and I tested every camera out there, even the smallest, lightest one that was available to me, like an IMO, would give me that would replicate that kind of incredible mobility that the human eye has. When you just look around the room and you take for granted the kind of very fragile, flexible mobility that the human eye has. So we started out by realizing no camera would accomplish this that existed out there. So we had to build a camera. This was about a year before we started to shoot. And we built a camera that literally could fit in the palm of your hand. It weighed 8 pounds. It was 35 millimeter with interchangeable lenses, prime lenses. And we outfitted it with a kind of modified Steadicam rig, which enabled you to give you the kind of fluidity of Steadicam. But I didn't want like a Steadicam attitude, meaning I didn't want it to feel really kind of graceful and floaty, because that's not the way. If you were running up those stairs and you were running away from somebody who was shooting you, you would not sort of float up those stairs. You'd be pounding up those stairs. So I needed, if we simply did it handheld, you'd be throwing up in the audience watching them. I mean, literally, you'd need air sick bags. I mean, this is just one challenge in making this. So what I did is I gave it, there's a piece of equipment that I use for Point Break. There's a foot chase in that called the Pogo Cam, which is a camera that weighs 18 pounds, which is gyro-stabilized, but it has no through-the-lens eyepiece. It has just a kind of a wire on top of the camera, so you kind of vaguely know what you're framing. So I wanted to kind of give the Steadicam a pogo attitude, and the pogo cam is just something you simply run with. It's on a stick, camera's on a stick, and it has a gyro-stabilizer at the bottom. We kind of adapted some elements from the pogo cam to the Steadicam with this new 8-pound camera. And there we finally had, and this I'm talking a year, was a lot of experimentation. We finally had a camera that could execute this, which I know looks really simple, but it wasn't. The other thing, just to kind of get us to the beginning, was I did storyboard the entire movie, and especially these POV, meaning points of view sequences. I say POV because these are sequences meant to be recorded directly off the cerebral cortex using the optical nerve as your lens. Hence, we call them POVs. In the movie, the vernacular that the character uses are clips. These are clips that are sold black market because the technology is illegal at the time of 1999. The technology isn't legal for civilian purposes. It was developed by the federal government to replace the audio wire for surveillance purposes, and it is legal in the federal community, but not on the street. And our character, Lenny Nero, played by Ray Fiennes, in an underground world, sells this technology to people who want to experience a kind of thrill, a vicarious adrenaline drive or anything their mind can imagine. Here at the very beginning of the movie, we have somebody who is in the middle of a robbery that clearly goes south, and it doesn't end up so well for the person who is recording this event, and this will then become part of the tone and texture of the movie. From this point on, you realize that anything is possible in terms of these recorded events. Another challenge in the film is that we chose to open with this clip, Fast and Furiously, to give the audience a kind of quick learning curve. So you understand when you're in a POV sequence, you understand a very simple, quick visual language when you're in POV sequence and when you're in objective storytelling. I suppose I could illustrate that if we were to go on and show you the next scene, which is shot objectively. But not objectively as opposed to subjectively, which is what this is. This is pure subjective camera. And we did that by creating both the illusion of a continuous and unbroken sequence, as you saw, and the shredding, which you see at the very beginning. There's a kind of computer-generated shredding of the image, and also through sound. So you instantly know you're in the POV, and you're going to experience somebody else's experience until it ends, and then the story continues. That's what I mean by the shredding. It's a style that actually took a little bit of time to develop, like about a year. One possibility was the idea of static, and having static be the way to interface in and interface out. But it felt too much like a video artifact and not a digital artifact. And I wanted this to appear to be absolutely digitally generated. And thinking that that would be the technology of choice, if this technology was available, that would be the technology of choice. So I wanted it to be a digital artifact and not a video artifact, so I want it to feel like it's pixelized, or a kind of pixelation of the image. That's how I arrived at this shredding, which we did in a combination of a Henry Bay and a computer animation bay, where we literally took the image and sped it up to just, I'm talking about probably three feet of image, and sped it up and kept reworking it and reworking it and laying it down again and again and again, sometimes speeding it up to like, or slowing it down in many cases to like 900 frames per second, and then looking at that at 10 frames per second, and we kept going back and forth over the image and literally decomposed and deconstructed the image in a computer-generated process that enabled us to get that kind of shredding. It's a process that doesn't have a lot of control. You basically are doing the artifact on the fly. As the image is going, you're hitting the dials on the fly. In other words, this shredding can never be duplicated again. You can get something close to it, but you can never get this exact kind of shredding again. You can output from the computer bay a negative that enables me to duplicate it in order to put it in the movie, but I can never create another original that's identical to this. So I created maybe 100 different versions of this particular shred, some that had solarizing, some that had more color contrast, less color, you know, less saturation of the image, higher saturation of the image, more pixelating, less pixelating. This in and of itself was a kind of visual language that took a lot of research and development, because that had never been done before, the kind of manipulation of the image. And I wanted a kind of immediate visual language that told you, the viewer, you were instantly in a POV. The other thing that, the other element that helps this learning curve, in other words, this instantaneous knowledge that you're instantly thrust into a POV and you're watching a POV, is going to be sound. And to achieve this shredding sound, this tearing of the image, which was sort of how I wanted it to feel like it began. In other words, like reality shreds literally and tears, and suddenly we're in this point of view, and then it digitally decomposes at the end. But through sound is another way of giving you the impression that the shredding is happening. To achieve that, it's basically created with sound. that is digitally created as well. So in other words, without that technology, I'm not sure it would have been a much cruder result. And then panning that sound as the image is shredding, and as you see, the original shot is moving, if you can see, to a certain extent, is moving from right to left. It's a complete 360-degree settling on the record deck, and that's when the image clears up. And the sound is panned from right to left, through the surrounds, through the matrix of the surrounds, through your center speakers, and back to the right, where we settle on the recorder. So I think sound is very important to achieve that shredding and decomposition of the image as well. Let me just back up for one second. In the shredding, my biggest fear was that I was going to have to end up with an entire sequence that was going to be an optical. And to have built a camera, 35mm, spent a year designing this, the last thing I wanted was to lose generations just because I needed that shredding at the beginning. So that was another mission parameter or objective that I had, was to achieve that shredding and not have to lose generations. So in fact, what happens is once I do make that shred, it clears up in a hard cut that's made indistinguishable because the camera is moving so quickly. So that's another thing that made this all very complicated, yet the end result is designed to look fairly simple. Now we're actually in the car and we're gonna go to this robbery. I wasn't able to find a contiguous location that gave me a street, a back of a restaurant, 6 flights of stairs, a rooftop, a roof that I could jump from one roof to another, and then on which I could drop. So we'll walk through all of the locations, but in the car, which is a street about 5 miles from the restaurant, is my camera operator, and the camera is not mounted. It's held in his hand, in his right hand, and I wish I had a photograph of this car. It's a car that we had to cut the roof off and open up and take out the top of the trunk. So you have in the trunk of this car, because I was seeing back, I was seeing forward, I couldn't be towed, I couldn't have my camera crew back there, all this had to be a self-contained unit. I have my camera operator dressed in the character's clothes. I have his right hand holding the camera. His left hand is an active hand that we use as part of the character. The right hand is a stuntman who is laying prone in the trunk of the car, who is also dressed in the character's clothes. Now that then completes the right hand. Now, this takes a lot of rehearsal because that camera's here, and in order for those shoulders not to look like, because you know your eye, your shoulders feel obviously fairly symmetrically placed on either side of your head. However, if you've got 5 people making up this one person, that's a little bit difficult. So I have this camera here, and here's his left hand, so he has to kind of adjust. And that stuntman, who is literally laying belly down in the trunk of the car over the back of the seat of the car with his right hand, is that one character's right hand. So when the gun is thrown to him, when the stocking is thrown to him, which I'll show you, the stocking being probably the single most difficult thing to execute in this entire movie, for both hands to work with absolute synchronicity and coordination. I mean, just imagine something you're very simple, you do it by yourself. You take the stocking. It doesn't only have to go over the person's head. It has to go over the lens of the camera because the lens are the eyes. Believe me, my crew looking at me when we were proposing how we're going to do this was, you want me to what? So here's the camera, basically, like this. Here's his left hand. The stocking gets thrown. He has to grab the stocking. Instantly, this guy back here has to act like this is the guy's right hand, and we have to adjust the camera so he can see, so it can't be right in front of him. He has to be able to see. There has to be some coordination there. And these hands have to work as if there are a united pair, pulling the stocking really quickly over the face. And meanwhile, the cameraman, because there are no actors other than the 2 actors in the front seat, but this person is also a character in and of himself, is also reading lines while all this is happening, which I then put voice over to later, but at the time, so the timing of it is correct, and and there is some kind of reality and pace to the sequence, he's back there saying, you know, what, you never give me the auto, I don't want the auto, I want, I want the auto, you always give me, you always get this piece of shit, etc. So he's back there trying to hold the camera, operate the shot, put on the stocking, coordinate with the stunt coordinator, and read lines. Now, I also have a focus puller who is also residing in the trunk. My focus puller is a brilliant, brilliant focus puller. So you can imagine this, seeing this car. If I could just show you this car moving down the street, the back of it is, sparks are flying. I now have about, and equipment. I've got a monitor in the back. So you have Mike, the focus puller, who's remote. He's laying prone over the stuntman's legs, whose belly is over the back of the seat. He's laying prone, looking at a monitor about a quarter the size of this, with his remote-controlled focus puller, trying to guess where, okay, now the stocking's in the front seat, now it's hitting the lens. You know, he's pulling focus back there as the car is, hitting bumps and as a result of the weight in the back seat of the car and lumbering down the street while all the actors, including the cameraman, are saying the lines. And there's no cuts. The entire length of that street, there are no cuts, obviously. There can't be. I mean, that's what it's designed to give you, the image. There are no cuts until the end. To the educated eye, probably the slightly uneducated eye, obviously there's a cut where you get out of the car. A cut that I tried very hard to disguise, but there had to be a cut there since this street lived about 5 miles away from the restaurant. So I had to cut. I had to create sleight of hand the illusion that this was an entirely contiguous piece of physical information. So as we get out of the car, what happens is the camera whips right and then gets out. Then we get to our other location, and the camera again whips left to right. In that duplicated whip pan is a cut that then allows me to carry on in my second location, which actually will take me all the way to the stairs. And I'll show you how I tried to disguise it. I tried to disguise it with sound, and this was less effective than some of my other cuts, but it was really a function of not being able to find two locations, or that location that was contiguous, and schedule, which didn't really permit me to make a move. I had to get this shot on this night, and I couldn't do it at the time when I did the restaurant, etc. Now we're going to go into the restaurant. This restaurant is a place, and this is all continuous. The entire sequence, and I'll show you, is continuous from the point when we leave the car to the point when we start up the stairs. And we are literally going across the parking lot into the front door. We hit the busboy. We knock him out. We take a right turn. We hear ahead of us the door slamming open because we've got two characters in front of us. We are number three. And we hit that door open. And in front of us, one of the characters already has one of the guys down. And then we continue on through the kitchen where chaos is erupting. The other character is trying to put one of the cooks' head into, like, the plate full of tomato sauce or something like that. And then we move through swing doors. Now we're at the head. The other two guys have run point. Now we've moved past them. And now we move into the restaurant, and we basically put out of play a couple of waitresses. And we grab a waitress just as she's trying to get out the front door. And now we go over to the cash register to see where the money is. And we pan over to catch the action of another waitress trying to get out the front door. And we pan over just in time to see one of our cohorts, our accomplices in crime, grab that waitress, put her out of action, and come around behind us to move the cashier aside, open up the cash register and realize that there's a lot of money hiding underneath the change tray, and then back everybody or move everybody down back behind us through the restaurant, through the kitchen, through the front door area, into the refrigerator where we shut the door and lock it with some kind of kitchen knife. And then that we say, do you have the money? We have the money. Again, the cameraman holds the money right up in front of the camera's face. And meanwhile, mind you, that the stocking is still on the lens because that still has to come off. And then move with our characters. Now we're going to make a run for it. And we move toward the front door, and we all start to hear sirens, and the first character who's starting to make a run for it realizes that the cops are there, but he decides to go and take his chances with the cops. We decide with our other guy that we're going to make a run for it, and we see the guy in front of us getting all freaked out and trying to decide which way to go, looks in the kitchen, looks at the stairs, realizes he's going to go to the stairs, runs to the stairs. We look in the kitchen. We see some lights of a cop car coming through the windows. We whip around. We race for the stairs. We take our stocking off, and we hit the stairs, and that's where our next cut is. But you have to appreciate that's a lot to accomplish in one take with one setup of lighting, basically, where I'm seeing 360 degrees. So we had to build in a lot of light gags that look like set so that I could be constantly whipping. I'm seeing the world. And there's my focus puller. So he's also very tall, much taller than my camera operator. And when you're whipping around, another sort of wonderful sight gag, if there was ever a making of, is in some of my 360s. I mean, this had to be so well coordinated. He's back there with his remote follow focus, you know, running like hell to keep up. My camera operator spins to look behind us. Mike has to drop, as well as the grip who's holding cable so that no, you know, like this entire team doesn't go toppling, because there's cable running back and forth on the floor behind the camera. So you've got somebody holding cable for the cable person. In other words, you've got three people right behind the camera operator who have to be well coordinated with what's happening in front of you, in addition to your two actors, all of your extras, and all of the sort of hostages in this restaurant. Also, anytime you see the right hand of the wearer who's wearing this equipment that enables us to experience this technology, is the stuntman who is the right hand. So he's literally strapped to that operator, hanging on to him. They're almost kind of like an octopus. You've got the operator like this with the left hand. Anytime you see the left hand, you know, like, get grabbing the money, that's the operator. Anytime you see the right hand in this particular sequence, sometimes we switch, but anytime you see the right hand, that's a stuntman who's literally, his chest is pressed to the back of the operator as close as he can get, and is coordinating everything with the right hand, doing all the business with a gun, slamming the gun on the restaurant owner's back, any of the gun, and, you know, hitting the waitress, hitting her aside, all that is coordinated with the stuntman. So it's almost like a kind of dance. You're probably wondering where I am in this. I'm as far away as I can be. What I did was I went there to this location, actually before we started shooting, with a video camera, and I walked through shooting the whole shot. So I knew where my whips were going to be, where my cuts were going to be, where all of my moves were going to be ahead of time. I mean, this is not, it's meant to look very spontaneous and chaotic and kind of crazy. It is so well rehearsed. There was no other way to do it. So anyway, I walk through this whole piece very slowly. Here's where we move here. Here's where we put the guy down. Here's where we pan up. I should see both characters in the shot. And I used, I think I just used friends to walk through this. And this is where we see the cook getting taken out. This is where we go through the doors. This is where we take out the two waitresses. This is where we take out the restaurant owner at the cash register. And so we had this basically a video storyboard, which is a replication of my drawn storyboards. So the video storyboard then becomes kind of the Bible, the template. Okay, now how do we do this, and how do we light it? And the most important thing, how do we do it at speed? So little by little, we kept rehearsing this. We'd go there sometimes on weekends as we're shooting the rest of the movie. We'd go on weekends before we shot the scene, obviously. And every time we go, we would do it faster and faster and faster and faster until we could do it at speed. Otherwise, if we had just started out at speed, it would have been a train wreck. If you can imagine all those people. I mean, it's like a human bipack kind of train that's moving through this location at speed. So when we're rehearsing, I'm, of course, there, and I'm, you know, left, right, no, this is where we had to turn left, and this is where we had to turn right, this is where I need the right hand, this is where I need the left hand, and et cetera. So I'm there walking right there with it until we actually are shooting. When we're shooting, The camera operator, who's the man holding the camera in the left hand, the active left hand, has a comm set that he can hear me. He can't speak back, but he can hear me. I am outside, obviously out of range of the camera because we are seeing 360 degrees. I am outside with a video monitor seeing the entire shot with the other half of the comm set speaking to him as he's shooting. Because he's moving so fast, he can kind of see exactly what he's framing. Let me just say one other thing. He is wearing something called a HID helmet. He has a video helmet which gives him his own video monitor, which hangs down, because there's no way you can keep your eye pressed to any kind of eyepiece with this kind of movement. So his camera is not in any way attached to his face. He has a video helmet that's called, a HID helmet, which means hidden, basically hidden camera. And there's a video camera tap from that little 8-pound camera that we built that is hanging over his left eye with an eye occlusion, which is basically a little black opaque disc that hangs over his right eye, which means that all he can ever see at speed, he is running, is that monitor. That's the only thing he can see. That eye's blacked out, and all he can see is this little 1-inch by 1-inch monitor on his left eye at speed. So I am outside, and sometimes, you know, I mean, he's moving fast, he's getting jostled, things are happening very, very quickly, so I am communicating to him if there's something that's not working in the shot, or if I can see both the set and I can see what's being shot, and I can say, you know, when you get to the door, pan left, pan left, pan left, you know, and, you know, or tilt up, tilt, whatever. We have a kind of very wonderful sort of quick language because we've worked together now, the Steadicam operator, and I've worked together since Blue Steel, so we work very well together, and he knows what I'm looking for, and he knows I can kind of give him a shorthand in the kind of heat of battle, and we can actually together execute the shot. The sequence of the car, take to shoot, we shot it in, we did about 15 takes, so 15 of the car rumbling down the road, 15 times, and that took to light and to shoot probably about 4.5 hours. That's a lot of lighting. But we probably were able to, in a case like that, when we had to light such a big expanse, we might have had a pre-rig crew give us the wiring for our big lights. And then we come in, I'm talking from just having electrical there, but no lights there. We come in, starting at like, you know, 0 hour to 4.5 hours. We come in, hang the lights, turn the lights on, rehearse, and shoot about 15 takes in about 4.5 hours. Later on, I'll show you where we did use a helmet camera. The problem with a helmet camera, when the camera is attached up here to the head, is it again loses that kind of mobility, or it becomes too jarring when you're moving too quickly like this because it's fixed. So that what this handheld camera with the kind of stripped down Steadicam apparatus takes away some of the movement, which really would prevent you from even understanding the image. I mean, you would have to take a Dramamine to experience this. Even as it is, I mean, it's a little intense in some places. But on the other hand, there's a sequence coming up which could not be executed any other way but with a helmet camera. The other problem with a helmet camera is it's very heavy. It weighs about 30 pounds, 28 pounds. And I don't know if you've ever put like a 28-pound weight on your head. It's tremendously... probably not very many of you have. It's very, very bad for these vertebrae right at the top of your neck. And it's just a very cumbersome, there's like kind of weird fluidity to it. I did a lot of tests with a helmet camera thinking that's how, I was going to be able to execute all this and not have to build a camera. And every time you turn your head, the camera would turn and then it would settle. So it'd be this weird, which is not like the human eye at all. You know, I need to whip and lock. But it would whip and kind of float to a stop, unless you put your hands up and stopped it, and that couldn't happen because I needed the hands. So, and also it's to the side, so you'd end up with photography that looked like, you know, you had about a 4-foot span between, you know, 4-foot wide shoulders. It was weird, and I couldn't interchange the lenses, so it didn't allow me the kind of pristine image I was looking for. We shot, actually, that restaurant, what you just saw, we shot the last night of photography, and that was our wrap night. Now, we spaced them out, and that was really due to the schedule and to location. Like, this was that street, the reason it couldn't be shot where the restaurant was shot was because I basically used a tail of a street that I was using for some of my riot footage. Once we were in kind of exterior street mode, I had to stay in and shoot out all my streets. And then when we, you know, the few interiors that we had, they had to be separated and shot at another time and place. So it really was just dictated by schedule and nothing else. It would have been nice to get all the clips done at once, but we couldn't do that. In the clips, these were all, we got a scratch track. What would happen is the sound man would come in to a location like that restaurant, and he would pre-rig the whole room with mics everywhere. And it was just a very rough scratch track that gave me, a scratch track is basically a throwaway track that just is a guide track and gives you a guide that you then post-sync that whole sequence. There was no way, and also the other thing about this little 8-pound camera is it couldn't be baffled. So it just chatters, you know, it chatters away. And your sound is unusable. So all the sound in the clips pretty much is, I would say exclusively is post-sunk. And that's another thing I want to talk about is sound and how we did our mix, because that was very critical. But we'll get to that once I'm done with the visuals. We thought about Super 16. I did some tests in it. And when you intercut it with the 35mm, it definitely, if you only saw it in Super 16, it wouldn't, your loss of clarity wouldn't be quite as noticeable, but when you cut it next to your 35mm, it then becomes somewhat noticeable. And since the technology was meant to be absolutely recorded off the cerebral cortex, and you know, in some ways kind of in some ways even more pure than the objective camera work, than the story of the movie, that it almost seemed like I was going to do anything in 16. It should be the story, but that was so predominant that didn't seem to make sense either. I mean, in a perfect world, you would change aperture, you'd change your aspect ratio for these clips because your eye doesn't see in scope either. You know, that was the other thing. We even toyed with the idea of somehow changing your aperture, your aspect ratio for these clips, but that became too complicated from a distribution standpoint, and so this was a kind of a compromise that seemed to be the most logical, but definitely we explored that. We tried to think through every aspect of this, and I thought about blinking in, you know, perhaps somehow either artificially or in the original photography incorporating some notion of blinks. But then I realized that when we blink, I mean, we even blink when we turn our heads, but we're not aware of it. So I was really looking for conscious observation as opposed to subconscious observation. And so that did narrow down my options nicely. You know, it gave me a little bit fewer options to work with. But we did take that into consideration. I suppose we could have morphed it, but then my problem was, first of all, expense. Time. And when I say morph, you could kind of just blend those images. You could literally just blend it, like with some kind of paint application program. But then I'm into an optical for the entire car and the entire restaurant. And that I didn't want to do, because the minute you get into an optical, you're going to lose a generation, and you're losing a generation anyway with your release prints. I was super 35, which meant that you have to do a squeeze blow up anyway to enable you to be released anamorphic, which is the 2:35 scope ratio. So I didn't want to lose another generation. And when you see it kind of in the, you know, when you're not analyzing it and you're just in the thrust of the story, I think the sound carries you through it, and you're kind of only aware of it, but marginally aware of it, unless you're really looking for it. But if you're just kind of there to let the story wash over you, there's a lot that. That's the other thing that I think is very interesting about editing. There's so much that you can really get away with, because in a way your mind does fill in the gaps, does kind of, you know, pull the images, make a kind of the correct association about two images that may not adhere perfectly, or sound has a tendency to help that out. A lot of times I have cuts that without the sound are hideous. You put the sound in and it's invisible. I think in the restaurant, I think I did about 8 takes of that whole sequence, and I could have, but I just found that this take gave me everything that I needed, and to be honest, I sort of liked the purity of it, and I didn't think that by cutting, maybe I got a little better look over her shoulder with the waitress, but a little less frightened host. You know, I mean, there's always something you get, something you lose, and I felt this just had an overall kind of seamless quality to it that I felt was worth preserving. And I was sort of proud of the fact we were able to kind of do it all in one, and I wanted to kind of protect that. And now also in that is the stocking coming off, you know, as we, with the right hand, the stunt coordinator's hand, as we're running to the stairs. Oh, I think that because the credits come at the end, they're not really, because this is sort of your, it's kind of like your credit sequence in a way. I mean, there's no credits, but this is your instant, it's almost like being the top of a roller coaster and, you know, the guy flips the switch and you're going into, you're right into the movie. And in the other two cases, the film starts in a much more sort of leisurely fashion. And so that's kind of like a curtain. The credit sequence is kind of like curtain, a curtain being pulled aside slowly. Whereas here, there's nothing slow about the beginning. You're just, you know, 1 second you're sitting down in the theater, and the next minute you're suddenly running. For some reason, you have no idea why. And of course, the whole movie explains it finally. 2 hours later, you understand. Any opportunity not to have to light to the extent that we had to light, which of course is for celluloid, and which high definition or some kind of digital recording would have given you. The problem is then when you go, you know, then when you go to your negative, plus if it was entirely, I mean, high definition is still, well, the camera is gigantic. So we would have had to design and fabricated a small high-definition camera. I mean, the camera is like that. There's no way you could execute any of that with that equipment. And but we did. I mean, that was one answer before we started to build this camera. I thought, well, that was, you know, that would take care of the entire thing. Could be seamless. And then I started investigating the equipment. And the lines, you know, you could double the lines, and the resolution wouldn't be too bad. And obviously, it would enable you to do any kind of computer-generated material, not loose generation, because once you're electronic, you're electronic, and you spit out one negative. But the equipment was too big, so every road led back to this. All the clips I rehearsed with a video camera, and but none of the other scenes. Only these clips. Only all the POV sequences I rehearsed with a video camera, like the Jericho kill, was. Heavily rehearsed. That was also very complicated, but yes, I do that a lot. And then I, you know, it enables us to just break it down and look at it, you know, literally frame by frame, go back out on another Saturday and do it again. And, you know, it's probably one of the least expensive, most efficient ways of rehearsing a complicated sequence. I also use a video, like a little lipstick camera on a model. If I have a complicated sequence like the shootout in Point Break of the sort of Nazi surfers. I don't know if you know that scene, but it's a scene where it's really this little house with all these rooms and all these like live little bits happening simultaneously. And to understand the geography of that, this guy's coming down the hallway, this guy's coming in the back window, this guy's coming in the other window, this guy's coming in the kitchen door. To understand the geography and to make all that coverage very, very clear, I used a lipstick camera inside a just basically a foam core model with, you know, little toy soldiers, and got all my shots and understood exactly how to shoot that sequence. So I use video kind of storyboards as well as drawn storyboards, but I start with the drawings and then I go to live action model, or in this case live action. Also, you have to appreciate one other thing, just kind of, you know, pat myself on the back a little bit, is you have to appreciate all the, you know, the coordination. Not only is my focus puller and my stuntman and the two guys holding cable dropping to the ground, but the police vehicles are having to drive up at the moment when he's running to the front door, which is all happening with several units standing next to me at the monitor, knowing when things are happening and communicating. I'm talking to the operator. I've got somebody talking to the police cars. I've got somebody else talking to the other members of the crew. Now you have to drop, you know, comm sets on everybody. That's another element. That is one thing to share. Anyway, and that's a real helicopter, too. One audience or interviewer or somebody says, well, how did you get that light up in the sky? And, you know, if you put a light up with a sound effect, right? I said, no, that is a real helicopter. Okay, so now the stairs. So again, 5 miles away, or however far away, we found the stairs and the roof. So the stairs and the roof are connected. However, because we had to change equipment and use a helmet camera for reasons I'll get to when we get out and onto the roof, I couldn't do that together, so I had to create a cut. Let me show you the two cuts, and then I'll show you how we lit it and how we executed this. So now we're in a new location, and we basically use the wipe across the wall as the cut point. So it's a right-to-left whip, a right-to-left whip. With what we did is we created a set wall in the restaurant location that we then took that set wall to the stereo location. So you had absolute duplication of both color and texture and tonal quality. Maybe the temperature of the light might be slightly different because it's hung in a slightly different position, but that would be the only difference whatsoever. It hit the wall, whip right to left, cut, go to the new location, on action, run toward that wall, hit, whip right to left, and then proceed up the stairs so you just cut in that, you cut basically in your whip. So, kind of a nice little trick. Anyway, so now we're running up the stairs, and again, you know, I'm on a monitor, hidden. We've basically lit it with overhead fluorescent light, but that's, you know, color corrected for the film stock that we were using, which was probably a 5296 or 98, you know, one of the faster stocks. And now we're having to coordinate with my two cops that are running through the bottom of the stairs, and when we pan down and see them, they've got to be there in time. And then we pan up. My other guy has to be at the sequence where he's shooting down at them. He's got to be, you know, he has to be shooting at the time when the camera sticks to him. So it's just, it's a lot of timing. It's an incredible dance of timing that enabled us to get accomplish the sequence. When we look down at the stairs and come up and cut, and then we back up a few feet, look down at the stairs and come up, and then we're able to come out up onto the roof. Now, the big challenge here, what probably why we did this the last two nights of photography, was we had to figure out a way, and it probably took close to about 3 years, to figure out a way to really safely execute this. I know it looks simple, but to do it very, very safely. And so what we did is we run up those stairs, we pan up, and again, this is all coordinated with a sort of series of people to my left and right on walkie-talkies as we are shooting this. But this is, again, a result of walking through this really slowly, week after week after week, with a video camera and, you know, with all the units present. So we know now when we pan up, but walking through it very slowly, now when we pan up, that helicopter has to be into position. Can't have run out of gas waiting up there. You know, in other words, all this has to be taken into consideration when I say action, when we're actually shooting. Is that helicopter, you know, is he coming into position? Is he, you know, is he refueled? Because he has something like 45 minutes of airtime that the FAA would allow us during a, you know, like a very small circumference of geographic space in this particular location in Los Angeles, which also dictated this the choice of this location. And would he have been refueled in position on all the other elements ready by the time I say action so that when we come up onto the roof, he's there. And not only is he there, but when the camera whips up, we're looking at each other and I wanted the light to flare the lens. This is not easy to do. But literally we probably, and let me tell you this, and that was all in one from one rooftop to another. And then the whip over to the explosion, that would be my first cut. So you're going up the stairs, out onto the roof, whip up, see the helicopter, run, come back down, follow your guy to the edge of the rooftop and see him jump from one rooftop to another, whip over to catch the explosion, and cut. Now, we did that in one take. I could not do it again for a couple of reasons. One is I got it all. Second of all, I was not going to go again because this guy jumped a 16 and a half foot span at speed from one building to another, and I was not going to risk that again. However, I did have an airbag at the bottom, which took a long time to disguise, and I'll show you, of course, we'll go back and look at it, but it took a long time to disguise. There was no way he was going to jump from one building to another without every precaution being taken care of. Now, he is the one, that person running in front, which is a stuntman. At the time when I cut to the stairs, I actually change actors. I go from the actor to doing all the kind of jive stuff in the car and the great stuff in the restaurant to a stuntman, because this is the stuntman that makes the jump. He's been through makeup and wardrobe, and he looks exactly like my actor, but I had to make that cut, not for technical reasons, but to change actors, because I had to move from an actor who could not make that jump, nor would you let the actor make the jump, to a stuntman who could make the jump. Now, he is the one, when you're working with a situation like that, he is the one that absolutely controls that shot. He can say cut. This is the only time when, other than a director, in an issue of safety, somebody else can say cut. And you completely, as a director, you say the set is in your hands. You are the one saying action and cut, and or I say action, but you are the one who says cut. You have the set. It's yours. If you feel uncomfortable, you feel like you're not on the right step, you know, like a horse going to a jump, you're not, you know, you've somehow missed, you want to go again, you're not psyched up for it. Even with the airbag, it's a really dangerous stunt. This is a 7-story high building. You're looking at hitting who knows what. You could hit the side of the wall. You could miss. There are a lot of things that that could happen. So I give you, you know, I basically said to him, I give you the set. If at any point you stop, then fine. You know, you just stop and we cut. Or if you want to go forward, obviously you're going to go forward. Now, let me tell you the other thing that's difficult. I have my cameraman, my operator, who's running at speed with the camera, with this HID helmet, with the video monitor right here, and that eye occluded. It's a really dangerous, dangerous situation. I have him strapped into a steel harness that is uncabled until partway down the run. So when we start the shot, we start on the stairs, going up those stairs, and he runs out onto the roof. Because you can't see anybody. You can't, you know, nobody can be around. Now I've got people hidden behind the opening out onto the roof that run up, my safety and stunt coordinators. So he comes up. Actually, that pause to look at the helicopter is also designed to be the pause, which he gets strapped in with a steel cable, which is weighted to some, you know, 5 billion pounds or however many tons, I'm not sure exactly. I've got X amount of people hanging onto that cable. That cable is calibrated not to let him go 1 inch over the edge of that roof. I mean, even if he missed his footing and fell or whatever, he will drop right at the edge of that roof. There's no way he can go any further. But that's why that timing where I cut to the stairs, I now have my stuntman who's controlling the shot, running the show, running up the stairs, running out onto the roof. I take my beat to look at the helicopter. He's rigged in. They tap him on the back, meaning he's strapped. It's like one of those kind of cables that, like a snap cable, you kind of hit and it snaps. And they know it's in place. All that's happening. Well, he's looking at the helicopter, and then he comes down. All this is, he's still moving. I mean, this is just a heartbeat up, a heartbeat down. Now he's running. Now, there's a point beyond which we designated, which is this little bit where the character jumps up onto the final roof before he jumps. Anyway, there's once he's on that place, it's kind of one of those points of no return, he said. He is not strapped in. Your stuntman, as you will see, has no safety cable. He has nothing on. Nothing's been painted out. He is there running, and he is going to jump that roof. And the kind of point of no return was, after that leap, he said if he made that leap, he's going too fast to stop anyway. So if he chooses to stop before that little jump, and I'll show you where it is, then we cut and all that. The minute he made that leap, I knew we were going. And as a director, it's probably the most frightening moment of, even more frightening than opening up the film at the London Film Festival, is that moment right there when you know this guy who is basically there to execute an extraordinarily difficult shot for you, putting his life in danger, even though he has signed off on every precaution we have taken. We have an ambulance at the site, we have the airbag, we have medical team, you know, at the ready. He has absolutely no protection whatsoever. He is there with his basically educated sanction of this sequence and how it was going to be executed. And this was about 2 years of planning that went into that one run and jump. And we did it the day before, the last day of principal photography, because it was so complicated and because it was so dangerous. And that's the most dangerous and probably the most difficult single piece of photography in the whole movie. But he obviously made it to the other side. and he was perfect, and we, you know, we panned over, we cut, and my cameraman, that's the other thing too. You know, you're running to a ledge like this. I mean, but full out running. The cameraman has to jump that little ledge. He's jumping and running. You have to appreciate it. He's carrying the camera, and he's running, jumping that little ledge. It's like running across here and up to here, and he's running. Once he knows we're going for it, so he sees the guy go for it. He knows he's got to. He's running. His life is in the hands of that cable, which he hopes is cabled. He can't look back and check. He can't do any checking himself. It's just the trust of the team that he has behind him. So he's running behind him, hanging on to now the steel cable, hoping that he won't trip, and his, you know, his footing is such that he'll stop when he gets to the edge of that roof. And of course, my stuntman jumps. It almost looks effortless for him, but of course, all of our hearts have skipped a beat. He gets to the other side, he rolls, he's perfectly in character, and my cameraman runs, gets to the edge, and looks over. Now, he's also leaning over the edge. I mean, he's out over the edge, hanging, hung there by that steel cable, which is now held taut. So that's what's holding him. But he has no idea that cable's there. That cable, he, when I said action, he started completely without any apparatus other than his harness. That's a lot of trust. All right, so my stuntman makes the leap. We make the look over. And what you see down there is, in fact, an airbag that is painted and airbrushed and dressed to look like cement, with garbage and, you know, twigs and dirt and all kinds of stuff. But in fact, that is an airbag that's like 8 feet deep by, well, that spans the gap of that alley. Then once we look, we pan over, that car explodes, which was basically the character who ran out front door and wants to face off with the, basically take his chances, face to face with the cops. And he then gets into kind of a bit of a car race and a game of chicken with the cops that ends in his car exploding, and that's basically his death. And we then whip off that explosion to the left. I say cut. That was a whole shot. That was all in one. Now we pick up from that explosion right to left. We make a cut on the whip again, and here's my actor over there saying, come on, jump, come on. Now, unfortunately, had we, the character, not hesitated there and maybe made our leap, maybe we would have made it, but we hesitated. And that was sort of the, that was what seals his fate. So just remember, he who hesitates is lost. And he turns around, he hears the cops behind him. Oh, there's so much to tell you in sound. Anyway, the sound, obviously the heartbeat starts to take over, and I'm panning that from speaker to speaker, and we pan the cops' voices coming from behind us. We hear them running around in the corner saying, you know, stop, you asshole, whatever they're saying. Their weapons are drawn. And on that whip back is my next and final cut. I had to cut because we then came back the next night, and, or actually it was the night before, we shot this part first because it took 2 days to install a 150-foot crane that is rigged from rooftop to rooftop. So we actually started shooting this sequence in reverse, which is why you have to be very organized in terms of your shots. But it took 2 days to install this crane, and we did it while we were shooting the material, some other scene somewhere else. They're installing this crane. So when we get there, this crane's installed, and the stuntman, not any longer my operator, stuntman is wearing a helmet camera, and he is hung from this. He's strapped to this crane, steel harness, steel cable. He's strapped to the crane, and we start the shot with him looking back, seeing the two cops running, and making a decision to go for it, and whipping forward, and running, and leaping out. And this is all done with a harness rig, and we are controlling it completely with a pulley system, leaping, grabbing the other side of the rooftop, hanging on, and kind of lifting up and seeing the character, you know, saying, come on, you know, grab hold, you know, and we're saying, don't let me go, don't let me go. We look down, oh my God, we just see our feet, our toes, trying to scrabble for support, and then we see our character, our friend, who is making kind of an end run with the cops, you know, like, you know, you die, motherfucker, or whatever he's saying. And the cops kill him, which of course means that he lets go of us, and we flick the switch on the cable. This is all done in real time. He drops at speed, but before he hits the airbag, he is gently floated to a stop, so safely. And he's wearing a 28-pound camera on his head. Had that pulley system not stopped him correctly, even hitting an airbag with a 28-pound harness on your head, is not going to be very good for your neck. So this was probably the second most dangerous stunt in the movie, and one which again took probably about 2.5 years to coordinate and brought us to this, I think, level of refinement in terms of its execution.